simply have treated your company as utterly ignorant bait for Nightingale. Lurked, waited until the Nightingale swallowed the hook, line and sinker. And then seized him as my own. For it's him I'm interested in. Him I want. And if you met your maker, a necessary evil, incidental. He fell silent. Geralt made no comment. Know you, Master Witcher, the prefect continued after a pause, that I swore to myself that the law would rule on my turf, at any cost, and using any methods, per fas et nefas. For the law is not jurisprudence, not a weighty tome full of articles, not philosophical treatises, not peevish nonsense about justice, not hackneyed platitudes about morality and ethics. The law means safe paths and highways. It means back streets one can walk along, even after sundown. It means inns and taverns one can leave to visit the privy, leaving one's purse on the table and one's wife beside it. The law is the sleep of people certain they'd be woken by the crowing of the rooster, and not the crashing of burning roof timbers. And for those who break the law, the noose, the axe, the stake, and the red-hot iron. Punishments which deter others. Those that break the law should be caught and punished, using all available means and methods. Eh, Witcher? Is the disapproval written on your countenance a reaction to the intention or the methods? The methods, I think. For it's easy to criticize methods, but we would all prefer to live in a safe world, wouldn't we? Go on, answer. There's nothing to say. Oh, I believe there is. Mr. Fulco, Geralt said calmly, the world you envision quite pleases me. Indeed? Your expression suggests otherwise. The world you envision is made for a witcher. A witcher would never be short of work in it. Instead of codes, articles, and peevish platitudes about justice, your idea creates lawlessness, anarchy, the license and self-serving of princelings and mandarins, the officiousness of careerists wanting to endear themselves to their superiors, the blind vindictiveness of fanatics, the cruelty of assassins, retribution and sadistic vengeance. Your vision is a world where people are afraid to venture out after dark, not for fear of cutthroats, but of the guardians of public order. For, after all, the result of all great crackdowns on miscreants is always that the miscreants enter the ranks of the guardians of public order en masse. Your vision is a world of bribery, blackmail and entrapment, a world of turning imperial evidence and false witnesses, a world of snoopers and coerced confessions, informing and the fear of being informed upon. And inevitably, the day will come in your world when the flesh of the wrong person will be torn with pincers, when an innocent person is hanged or impaled. And then it will be a world of crime. In short, he finished, a world where a witcher would be in his element.
Well, well,
Fulco Arteveldi said after a moment's silence, rubbing his eye socket through the leather patch.
An idealist, a witcher, a professional, a hired killer, but an idealist nonetheless, and a moralist. That's dangerous in your profession, witcher. A sign you begin to outgrow your profession. One day you'll hesitate to dispatch a Strigger. For what if it's innocent? What if it's blind vengeance and blind fanaticism? I don't wish it on you. But what if, one day? I don't wish this on you either, though it is possible. What if someone close to you is harmed in a cruel and sadistic way? Then I'd willingly return to this conversation, to the issue of the punishment fitting the crime. Who knows if we would then differ so greatly in our views. But today, here, now, that is not the subject of our consideration or discussion. Today we shall talk about hard facts, and you're a hard fact.
Geralt raised an eyebrow slightly.
Though you were scornful about my methods and my vision of a world of law, you shall aid me, my dear Witcher, in the fulfilling of that vision. I repeat, I swore to myself that those who break the law will get their just deserts, all of them. From the minor felon who cheats with dishonest scales at the market to he who swipes a cargo of bows and arrows meant for the army on the highway. Highwaymen, cutpurses, thieves, robbers, terrorists from the Free Slopes organization who grandly call themselves freedom fighters. And Nightingale, above all, Nightingale. A fitting punishment must befall Nightingale. The method is inconsequential.
as long as it's quick, before an amnesty is declared and he weasels out. Richard, I've been waiting months for something that'll let me get one step ahead of him, that'll let me nudge him, make him trip up and make the decisive error which will be his undoing. Shall I continue, or do you follow?
I do, but go on.
The mysterious half-elf, seemingly the initiator and instigator of the attempt, warned Nightingale about Avitra, advocated caution, advised against a cavalier attitude or swaggering arrogance and bravado. I know he had his reasons. The warning will come to nothing, though. Nightingale will make a mistake. He will attack Avitra, who has been forewarned and is prepared to defend himself. Avitra, who is waiting to be attacked, and it'll be the end of the robber Nightingale. I wish to strike a bargain with you, Geralt. You shall be my informer. Don't interrupt. It's a simple agreement. Each side will meet their obligations. You put paid to Nightingale, while in exchange I...
He was silent for a while, smiling slyly.
I shan't ask you who you are, where you're from, or where and why you journey. I shan't ask why one of you speaks with a barely detectable Nilfgaardian accent, and why sometimes dogs and horses bristle at your party's approach. I shan't order the roll of papers to be taken from the troubadour Dandelion, nor shall I check what they say. And I shall only inform Imperial counterintelligence about you when Nightingale is dead or in my dungeon. Or even later. Why hurry? I'll give you time and a chance.
A chance to do what?
To reach Toussaint. That ridiculous fairy tale duchy whose borders even an Nilfgaardian counterintelligence don't dare violate. And then much may change. There'll be an amnesty. There may be a truce on the far side of the Yaruga. Maybe even lasting peace.
The Witcher was silent for a long time. The prefect's disfigured face was unmoving. His eye shone.
Agreed, Geralt finally said.
Without haggling? Without conditions?
I have two.
How could it be otherwise? Go on.
I must first ride west for a few days. To Loch Monduin. To the Druids, since...
Are you making an ass of me?
Fulke Artevelde interrupted abruptly.
Do you mean to gull me? West? Everyone knows where your route takes you, including Nightingale, who is right now laying an ambush on your road. To the south. In Belhaven, at a spot where the Navy Valley cuts the Sans-Retour Valley, leading to Toussaint. Does that mean that the Druids aren't by Loch Monduin?
No, nor have they been for almost a month. They headed down the Sans-Retour Valley to Toussaint under the protective wings of Duchess Anarietta of Beauclair, who has a weakness for freaks, loonies, and oddballs, who gladly gives asylum to such in her little fairy-tale land. You know that as well as I do, Richard. Don't try to dupe me.
I won't try, Geralt said slowly. I give you my word that I won't. I set out for Belhaven tomorrow.
Haven't you forgotten something?
No, I haven't forgotten. My second condition. I want Angoulême. You'll rush through her amnesty and release her from the dungeon. This Witcher informer needs your informer. Quickly, do you agree or not?
I do,
Fulke Artevelde replied almost at once.
I have no choice. Angoulême is yours, for I know you're only cooperating for her sake.
The vampire riding at Geralt's side listened attentively and didn't interrupt. The Witcher wasn't disappointed by his perspicacity.
There are five of us, not four, he concluded, as soon as Geralt had finished his account. We've been travelling in a group of five since the end of August. The five of us crossed the Yaruga, and Milva only cut off her plait in Rivendell about a week ago. Your fair-haired protégé knows about Milva's plait, but said four, not five. Bizarre.
Is that the strangest part of this bizarre story?
Far from it. The strangest thing is Belhaven, the town where the ambush has reputedly been laid for us, a town set deep in the mountains, on the path through the Navy Valley and the Theodula Pass.
And we never plan to go there,
the Witcher finished, spurring on Roach, who was beginning to fall behind.
3 weeks ago, when that highwayman Nightingale took the job to kill me from some half-elf, we were in Angren, heading to Caerdhu,
fearful of the Isgith bogs. We didn't even know we'd have to cross the Yaruga. Damn it, we didn't know that this morning.
We did, the vampire interrupted. We knew we were looking for the druids. We knew that just as clearly this morning as 3 weeks ago. That mysterious half-elf is preparing an ambush on the road leading to the druids. Certain we'll take that road. He simply has a better idea than us which way that road leads.
It was the witch's turn to interrupt.
How does he?
We shall have to ask, which is precisely why you took the prefect's offer, isn't it?
Naturally. I'm counting on being able to have a chat with Mr. Half-Elf.
Geralt smiled hideously.
Before that happens, doesn't any explanation suggest itself to you, or simply come to mind?
The vampire observed him in silence for some time.
I don't like what you're saying, Geralt, he said at last.
I don't like what you're thinking. I consider it an inopportune thought, taken hurriedly without reflection, resulting from prejudice and resentment.
How else can one explain? Any way?
Regis interrupted him with a tone Geralt had never heard from him.
Any way but like that? Don't you think, for example, there's a possibility your fair-haired protégé is lying?
Hey there, Nuncle,
called Angoulême, riding behind them on the mule called Drachul.
Don't accuse me of lying if you can't prove it.
I'm not your uncle, dear child.
And I'm not your dear child, Nuncle.
Angoulême.
The witcher turned around in the saddle.
Be quiet.
Did you say so?
Angoulême calmed down immediately.
You're allowed to give me orders. You got me out of that hole, wresting me from Mr. Fulco's talons.
I obey you. You're now the leader, the head of the Hansa.
Be quiet, please.
Angoulême muttered under her breath, stopped urging Dracul on, and remained at the rear, particularly since Regis and Geralt had put on speed to catch up with Dandelion, Gaer, and Milva, who were riding in the vanguard. They were heading towards the mountains along the bank of the River Nedi, whose waters, turbid and yellowish-brown following the last rains, rolled swiftly over rocks and shelves. They weren't alone. They frequently passed or overtook troops of Nilfgaardian cavalry, lone horsemen, settlers' wagons or merchants' caravans. The Amel Mountains rose up to the south, closer and closer and more menacing, and the pointed needle of Gorgon, Devil Mountain, was enveloped in the clouds, which quickly covered the whole sky.
When are you going to tell them?
The vampire asked, indicating with a glance the threesome riding ahead of them.
When we make camp.
Dandelion was the first to speak when Geralt had finished his account.
Correct me if I'm wrong, he said, but that girl, Angoulême, whom you have so cheerfully and carelessly added to our company, is a criminal. To save her from her well-deserved penalty, you've agreed to collaborate with the Nilfgaardians. You've hired yourself out.
Why, not just yourself. You've hired us all out. We are all to assist the Nilfgaardians capture or kill somebody, some local brigand. In short, you, Geralt, have become a Nilfgaardian mercenary, a bounty hunter, a hired assassin, and we've been promoted to the rank of your acolytes, or perhaps your family.
You have an incredible talent for oversimplification, Dandelion, Gaia muttered. Have you really not understood what this is about? Or are you just talking for talking's sake?
Silence, Nilfgaardian!
Geralt?
Let me begin by saying...
The Witcher threw a stick he'd been playing with for some time onto the fire.
That no one's forced to help me with my plans. I can handle it by myself, without acolytes or family.
You're audacious, Nuncle, Angoulême began. But Nightingale's Hansa numbers 24 stout blades. They won't take fright at a witcher. And where it concerns swordsmanship, even if it were true what they say about witches, no witch could deal with 24 by himself. You saved my life, so I'll repay you likewise, with a warning, and with help.
What the bloody hell is a Hansa?
In Hansa, Gaer explained. In our tongue, it's an armed gang, but one linked by bonds of friendship.
A company?
Precisely. I see the word has entered the local slang here.
A Hansa's a Hansa,
Angoulême interrupted. In our lingo, a gang or hussar.
What are we on about here? That was a serious warning. One man has no chance against the entire Hansa. To make matters worse, one who knows neither Nightingale nor anyone in Bellhaven or the surroundings, neither foes, friends nor allies, who knows not the roads leading to the town, and there are various. I say the Witcher won't cope. I don't know what customs prevail among you, but I won't leave the Witcher alone. As Nuncle Dandelion said, he cheerfully and carelessly took me into your company, even though I'm a criminal. My hair still stinks of the cell. There was no way of washing it. The Witcher and no other got me out of that cell and into the daylight. I'm grateful to him for that, which is why I won't leave him alone. I'll lead him to Bellhaven, to Nightingale and that half-elf. I'm going with him.
Me too, Kaia said at once.
And me and all, Milva barked.
Dandelion pressed to his chest the tube with the manuscripts, which lately he wouldn't be parted from for a single moment. He lowered his head. He was evidently struggling with his thoughts, and the thoughts were winning.
Stop meditating, poet, Regis said kindly, for there's nothing to be ashamed of. You're even less cut out to participate in a bloody sword fight than I am. We weren't taught to carve up our neighbours with a blade. Furthermore, I'm...
He raised his shining eyes towards the Witcher and Milva.
I'm a coward, he confessed curtly. If it's not necessary, I don't want to go through what we had on the ferry and the bridge again. Never. For which reason, I request to be left out of the fighting team heading to Bellhaven.
You looked me from that ferry and that bridge on your back, Milva began softly, when infirmity robbed me of my legs. If there'd been a coward there, instead of you, he'd have left me and fled. There was no coward, though. Only you, Regis.
Well said, Auntie, said Angoulême with conviction. I have no clue what you're on about, but well said. I'm no aunt of yours.
Milva's eyes flashed ominously. Have a care, miss. If you call me that again, you'll see.
What will I see?
Quiet, the Witcher barked harshly. That's enough, Angoulême. I need to take all of you to task, I see. The time of lurching blindly towards the horizon is over. For now, there might be something just over the horizon. The time for decisive action has arrived. Time for throats to be cut. For at last there's someone to attack. Those who haven't understood till now, let them understand. We finally have a clear-cut enemy within reach. The half-elf who wants us dead is an agent of forces hostile to us. Thanks to Angoulême, we've been forewarned. And forewarned is forearmed, as the proverb has it. I have to get my hands on that half-elf and wring from him whose orders he's acting on. Do you finally understand, Dandelion?
I'd say, the poet began calmly, that I understand more and better than you. Without any attacking or ringing needed, I surmise that the mysterious half-elf is acting on Dykstra's orders, the same Dykstra you lamed on Thaneth by smashing his ankle. Following Marshal Visigerd's report, Dykstra doubtless considers us Nilfgaardian spies. And, following our flight from the core of Lyrian partisans, Queen Maeve has assuredly added a few points to the list of our crimes.
You're mistaken, Dandelion, Regis softly interjected. It's not Dykstra, or Visigerd, or Maeve.
Then who?
Any judgment or conclusion now would be premature.
Agreed, the Witcher drawled icily, which is why the matter needs to be examined in situ, and conclusions drawn first hand.
And I, Dandelion said, not giving up, still judge it a stupid and risky idea. It's good we've been warned about the ambush, that we know about it. Now that we know, let's give it a wide berth. Let that elf, or half-elf, wait for us as long as he wishes, and we'll hurry along our own road.
No, the Witcher interrupted. That's the end of the discussion, my little chicks. The end of anarchy. The time has come for our Hansa to have a ringleader.
Everyone, not excluding Angoulême, looked at him in expectant silence.
Angoulême, Milva and I, he said, will make for Bellhaven. Kaia, Regis and Dandelion will ride into the Sans Retour Valley and go to Toussaint.
No,
Dandelion said quickly, gripping his tube more tightly.
Not a chance. I can't.
Shut up. This isn't a debate. It was an order from the Hansa's leader. You're going to Toussaint with Regis and Cahir. You'll wait for us there.
Toussaint means death for me, the troubadour declared emphatically. If I'm recognised in Beauclair, at the castle, I'm dead. I have to tell you.
No, you don't, the Witcher interrupted bluntly. It's too late. You could have turned back, but you didn't want to. You remained in the company in order to rescue Ciri, am I right?
You are.
So, you'll ride with Regis and Kaia down the Sans Retour Valley.
You'll wait for us in the mountains without crossing the Tucson border for now. But if the necessity arises, you'll have to cross it. For the druids, the ones from Kaidu, Regis' acquaintances, are allegedly in Tucson. So, if the necessity arises, you'll get information about Ciri from the druids and set off to get her. Alone.
What do you mean, alone? Do you anticipate...
I'm not anticipating. I'm bearing in mind the possibility. Just in case, so to speak. As a last resort, if you prefer. Perhaps it'll all go well and we won't have to show up in Tucson. But in the event... Well, then it's important that a Nilfgaardian force doesn't follow you to Tucson.
Well, it won't, Angoulême cut in. It's strange, but Nilfgaard respects Tucson's marches. I've hidden from pursuers there before. But the knights there are no better than the Blackcloaks. Refined and courteous in their speech, but quick to seize the sword or lance. And they patrol the marches ceaselessly. They're called knights errant. They ride alone or in twos or threes, and they persecute the rabble, which means us. Witcher, one detail needs changing in your plans.
What?
If we are to make for Belhaven and cross swords with Nightingale, you and Sir Kair should go with me and let Auntie go with them.
Why so?
Geralt calmed Milva with a gesture.
You need men for that job. Why are you raging, Auntie? I know what I'm talking about. When the time comes, it may be necessary to act with menace rather than force itself. And none of Nightingale's Hansa will be scared of a band of three where there are two women to one man.
Milva rides with us.
Geralt clenched his fingers around the archer's forearm, who was genuinely infuriated.
Milva, not Kair. I don't want to ride with Kair.
Why's that?
Angoulême and Kair asked almost at the same time.
Precisely,
Regis said slowly.
Why?
Because I don't trust him, the witcher said bluntly.
The silence which fell was unpleasant, weighty, almost tangible. From the forest, near which a merchant's caravan and a group of other travellers had made camp, came raised voices, shouts and singing.
Explain, Kaia said at last. Somebody has betrayed us, the witcher said dryly. After our conversation with the prefect and Angoulême's revelations, there's no doubt about it. And if one thinks it over carefully, one comes to the conclusion that there's a traitor among us, and it takes little pondering to guess who.
It seems to me, Kaia frowned, that you have taken the liberty to suggest that the traitor is me.
I don't deny that such a thought has occurred to me.
The witch's voice was cold.
There's much to suggest it. It would explain much, very much.
Geralt, said Dandelion, aren't you going a mite too far? Let him speak.
Kaia curled his lip.
Let him speak.
Let him feel free. It puzzled us.
Geralt swept his gaze over his companions' faces. How there could have been an error in the reckoning. You know what I'm talking about. That there are five of us and not four. We thought someone had simply made a mistake. The mysterious half-elf, the brigand Nightingale, or Angoulême. But if we reject that, then the following possibility suggests itself. The company numbers five, but Nightingale is only meant to kill four, because the fifth is the assassin's accomplice. Someone who keeps them constantly informed about the company's movements. From the start, from the moment the celebrated fish soup was eaten and the company was formed. And we invited an Nilfgaardian to join us. An Nilfgaardian who must catch Ciri, must hand her over to Emperor Emir, for his life and further career depends on it.
So I wasn't wrong then, Kaia said slowly. I'm a traitor after all. A lousy, two-faced turncoat?
Geralt, Regis began again, excuse my frankness, but your theory is riddled with holes, and your thought, as I've already told you, is inopportune.
I'm a traitor, Kaia repeated, as though he hadn't heard the vampire's words. As I understand it, however, there is no proof of it, only vague circumstantial evidence and the witch's speculations. As I understand it, the burden of proving my own innocence falls on me. So I'll have to prove I'm not what I appeared to be. Is that right?
Don't be pompous, Nilfgaardian, snapped Geralt, standing before Kaia and glaring at him. If I had proof of your guilt, I wouldn't be wasting time talking. I'd have filleted you like a herring already. Do you know the principle of cui bono? So answer me.
Who, aside from you, had even the slightest reason to betray me? Who, aside from you, would have gained anything from it?
A loud and long-drawn-out crack resounded from the merchant's camp. A firework exploded in a burst of red and gold. Rockets shot out a swarm of golden bees, and coloured rain fell against the black sky.
"I'm not what I appear,"
said the young Nilfgaardian, in a powerful, resonant voice.
"Unfortunately, I can't prove it. But I can do something else. Do what befits me, what I have to do when I'm being slandered and insulted, when my honour is besmirched and my dignity sullied."
His attack was as swift as lightning, but it still wouldn't have surprised the Witcher had it not been for Geralt's aching knee, which hampered his movements. Geralt was unable to dodge, and the gloved fist smashed him in the jaw with such force he fell backwards and tumbled straight into the campfire, throwing up clouds of sparks. He leapt up, too slow again owing to the pain in his knee. Caer was already upon him. Again, the Witcher didn't even manage to duck. The fist rammed into the side of his head, and colourful fireworks flared up in his eyes, even more glorious than the ones the merchants had set off. Geralt swore and pounced on Caer, wrapped his arms around him, and knocked him to the ground. They rolled around in the gravel, thumping and pummeling each other. And all in the eerie and unnatural light of the fireworks bursting in the sky.
"Stop it!" Dandelion yelled. "Stop it, you bloody fools!"
Caer artfully knocked the ground out from under Geralt and smote him in the teeth as he was trying to get up, and punched him again. Geralt crouched, tensed, and kicked him, not in his crotch, where he had aimed, but in the thigh. They grappled again, fell and rolled over, thumping one another wherever they could, blinded by the punches and the dust and sand getting into their eyes. Then suddenly they came apart, rolling in opposite directions, cowering and shielding their heads from the blows raining down on them. Having unfastened her sturdy leather belt, Milva had seized it by the buckle, wound it around her fist, fallen on the fighters, and begun to flog them with lusty blows with all her might, sparing neither the strap nor her arm. The belt whistled and fell with a dry crack, first on Caer's, then on Geralt's arms, back and shoulders. When they parted, Milva hopped from one to the other like a grasshopper, thrashing them evenly so that neither of them received any less or any more than the other.
"You thick-heads," she yelled,
cracking Geralt across the back.
"You doltish dolts, I'll teach you both a lesson."
"Enough," she yelled even louder, lashing Caer's arms with which he was shielding his head.
"Had enough. Calm down now." "Stop," the Witcher howled. "Enough."
"Enough," echoed Caer, who was huddled up in a ball.
"That'll do."
That will suffice, said the vampire. That really will suffice, Milva.
The archer was panting heavily, wiping her forehead with her fist, belt still wound around it.
"Bravo," said Angoulême. "Bravo, auntie."
Milva turned on her heel and thrashed her across the shoulders with all her might. Angoulême screamed, sat down, and burst into tears.
"I told you," Milva puffed, "not to call me that. I told you."
"It's all right."
In a somewhat shaking voice, Dandelion reassured the merchants and travellers who'd run over from the neighbouring campfires.
"Just a misunderstanding between friends. A lover's tiff. It's already been patched up."
The Witcher probed a wobbly tooth with his tongue and spat out the blood dripping from his cut lip. He felt the welts beginning to rise on his back and shoulders, and his ear, which had been lashed by the strap, seeming to swell to the dimensions of a cauliflower. Beside him, Caer clumsily hauled himself up from the ground, holding his cheek. Broad red marks quickly spread over his exposed forearm. Rain, smelling of sulphur, ash from the last firework, was falling on the ground. Angoulême sobbed woefully, holding her shoulders. Milva threw aside her belt, then, after a moment's hesitation, knelt, embraced, and hugged her without a word.
"I suggest," said the vampire frigidly, "that you shake hands. I suggest never, ever revisiting this matter."
Unexpectedly, a gale came down from the mountains in whispered gusts, in which it seemed some kind of ghastly howling, crying, and wailing could be heard. The clouds, being blown across the sky, took on fantastic shapes as the crescent moon turned as red as blood. They were woken before dawn by a furious chorus of goat-sucker nightjars and the whirring of their wings. They set off just after the rising of the sun, which later lit up the snows on the mountain peaks with blinding flame. They had left much earlier than that, before the sun had appeared from behind the peaks. Actually, before it appeared, the sky had become overcast. They rode amongst forests, and the road led higher and higher, which was discernible in the tree species. The oak and hornbeam finished abruptly, and they rode into a gloom of beech lined with fallen leaves, smelling of mould, cobwebs and mushrooms. The mushrooms were in abundance. The damp year-end had yielded a plentiful harvest. In places, the forest floor literally vanished beneath the caps of seps, morels and agarics. The beechwood was quiet and looked as though most of the songbirds had flown away to their mysterious winter haven. Only crows at the edge of the undergrowth cawed, feathers dripping. Then the beech ended and spruce replaced it. The scent of resin filled the air. More and more often, they encountered bald hillocks and stone runs where they were caught by strong winds. The River Nevi foamed over steps and cascades. Its water, in spite of the rain, had turned crystal clear. Gorgon loomed up on the horizon, ever closer. All year long, glaciers and snows flowed from the angular sides of the huge mountain, which meant Gorgon always looked as though it were clad in white sashes. The peak of Devil Mountain was constantly swathed in veils of clouds, like the head and neck of an enigmatic bride. Sometimes, though, Gorgon shook her white raiment like a dancer. The sight was breathtaking, but brought death. Avalanches ran from the peak's sheer walls, wiping out everything in their path, down to the scree at the foot and further down the hillside, to the highest spruce stands above the Theodula Pass, above the Navy and Sans Retour valleys, above the black circles of mountain tarns. The sun, which in spite of everything had managed to penetrate the clouds, set much too quickly. It simply hid behind the mountains to the west, setting light to them with a purple and golden glow. They stopped for the night. The sun rose, and the time came for them to part. Milva carefully wrapped a silk scarf around her head. Regis put on his hat. Yet again, Geralt checked the position of the sail on his back and the daggers in his boots. Beside them, Caer was wetting his long Nilfgaardian sword. Angoulême tied a woolen band around her forehead and slipped a hunting knife, a present from Milva, into her boot. The archer and Regis saddled up their horses. The vampire handed Angoulême the reins to his black while he mounted the mule, Drachul. They were ready. Only one thing remained to be taken care of.
"Come here, everybody."
They approached.
"Caer, son of Kyailach," Geralt began, trying not to sound pompous. "I wronged you with unfounded suspicion and behaved shabbily towards you. I hereby apologize before everyone with bowed head. I apologize and ask you to forgive me. I also ask you all for forgiveness, as I shouldn't have made you watch or listen to it. I vented my fury and resentment on Caer and all of you. It was caused by knowing who betrayed us. I know who betrayed and abducted Ciri, whom we aim to rescue. I'm angry because I'm talking about a person who was once very close to me. Where we are, what we're planning, what route we're taking and whither we're heading, all was uncovered with the help of scanning, detecting magic. It's none too difficult for a mistress of magic to remotely detect and observe a person who is once well-known and close, with whom they had a long-term psychic contact which permits the creation of a matrix. But the sorcerer and sorceress of whom I speak made a mistake. They've revealed themselves. They made an error when counting the members of the company, and that error betrayed them. Tell them, Regis."
"Geralt may be right," Regis said slowly. "Like every vampire, I'm invisible to magical visual probing and scanning. That is, to a detecting spell. A vampire may be tracked using an analytical spell from close up, but it is not possible to detect a vampire with a remote scanning spell. The detection will report that there's no one there. Thus, only a sorcerer could be mistaken regarding us, to register four people where there were actually five. That is, four people and one vampire.
We shall exploit the sorcerer's error, the Witcher continued. Kair, Angoulême and I shall ride to Belhaven to talk to the half-elf who hired assassins to kill us. We won't ask the half-elf on whose orders he's acting, for we know that already. We'll ask him where the sorcerers on whose orders he is acting are. When we learn their location, we'll go there and exact our revenge. Everybody was silent. We stopped counting the date, so we haven't even noticed it's the 25th of September. 2 days ago, it was the night of the equinox. The equinox. Yes, that's exactly the night you're thinking about. I see your dejection. I see what your eyes are saying. We received a signal that dreadful night when the merchants camping beside us were keeping their courage up with aqua vitae, singing and fireworks. You probably had a less distinct sense of foreboding than Kair and I, but you're speculating too. You suspect, and I'm afraid your suspicions are well-founded. The crows flying over the moorland cawed. Everything indicates that Ciri is dead. She perished 2 nights ago at the equinox. Somewhere far from here, alone amongst hostile people. Strangers. And all that's left to us is vengeance. A cruel and bloody revenge about which stories will still be told 100 years hence. Stories which folk will be afraid to listen to after nightfall, and the hand of any who would repeat such a crime will tremble at the thought of our vengeance. We shall give a horrible example of terror, using the ways of Mr. Fulco Arteveldi, wise Mr. Fulco, who knows how blackguards and scoundrels should be treated. The illustration of terror we shall give will astonish even him. So let us begin, and may hell assist us. Kair, Angoulême, to horse. We ride up the Navy towards Belhaven. Dandelion, Milva, Regis, make for Sans Retour towards Toussaint's borders. You won't get lost. Gorgon will point the way. Goodbye.
Ciri stroked the black cat, which had returned to the cottage in the swamp, as is customary with all cats in the world, when its love of freedom and dissolution had been undermined by cold, hunger and discomfort. Now it was lying in the girl's lap and arching its back against her hand with a purr signifying profound bliss. The cat couldn't have cared less about what the girl was saying.
"It was the only time I dreamed of Geralt," Ciri began. "From the time we parted on the Isle of Thanet, from the Tower of the Seagull, I'd never seen him in a dream. So I thought he was dead. And then suddenly came that dream, like the ones I used to have, dreams which Yennefer said were prophetic, precognitive, that they either show the past or the future. That was the day before the equinox, in a small town whose name I don't recall, in a cellar where Bonnart had locked me, after he'd flogged me and made me admit who I am."
"Did you divulge to him who you are?"
Visigotta raised his head.
"Did you tell him everything?"
"I paid for my cowardice," she swallowed, "with humiliation and self-contempt."
"Tell me about your dream."
"In it, I saw a mountain. Lofty, sheer and sharp like a stone knife. I saw Geralt. I heard what he was saying, exactly. Every word, as though he were with me. I remember I wanted to call out and say it wasn't like that at all, that none of it was true, that he'd made an awful mistake, that he'd got everything wrong. That it wasn't the equinox yet, so even if I happened to have died on the equinox, he shouldn't have declared me dead earlier, when I was still alive. And he shouldn't have accused Yennefer or said such things about her."
She was silent for a time, stroking the cat and sniffing hard.
"But I couldn't say a word. I couldn't even breathe. As though I was drowning. And I awoke. The last thing I saw, that I recall from that dream, was three riders, Geralt and two others, galloping along a ravine with water gushing from its walls."
Visigotta said nothing. Had someone crept up to the shack with the sunken, moss-grown, thatched roof after nightfall?
Had they peered through the gaps in the shutters, they would have seen a grey-bearded old man listening raptly to a story told by an ashen-haired girl in the dimly lit interior, her cheek disfigured by a nasty scar. They would have seen a black cat lying on the girl's lap, purring lazily, demanding to be stroked, to the delight of the mice scampering around the room. But no one could have seen it, for the cottage with the sunken moss-grown thatched roof was well hidden among the fog in the boundless Periplut marshes, where no one dared to venture. It is well known that when a witcher inflicts pain, suffering and death, he experiences absolute ecstasy and bliss, such as a devout and normal man only experiences during sexual congress with his wedded spouse, ibidem cum ejaculatio. This leads one to conclude that, also in this matter, also, a witcher is a creature contrary to nature, an immoral and filthy degenerate, born of the blackest and most foul-smelling hell, since surely only a devil could derive bliss from suffering and pain. Anonymous. Monstrum, or a description of a witcher. Chapter 6. They left the main track, leading along the Navy Valley, and took a short cut through the mountains. They rode as quickly as the track would allow. It was narrow and winding, hugging fantastically shaped rocks covered in patches of colourful moss and lichen. They rode between vertical rocky cliffs from which ragged ribbons of cascades and waterfalls tumbled. They rode through ravines and gorges, across small rickety bridges, over precipices at the bottom of which streams seethed with white foam. The angular blade of Gorgon seemed to rear up directly above their heads. The peak of Devil Mountain was not visible, but shrouded in the clouds and fog cloaking the sky. The weather, as happens in the mountains, worsened in the course of a few hours. It began to drizzle, bitingly and disagreeably. When dusk fell, the three of them nervously and impatiently looked around for a shepherd's bothy, a tumble-down barn, or even a cave, anything that would protect them from the weather during the night.
"I think it's stopped raining," Angoulême said hopefully. "It's only dripping from the holes in the roof now. Tomorrow, fortunately, we'll be near Belhaven, and we can always sleep in a shed or a barn on the outskirts."
"Aren't we entering the town?"
"Out of the question. Mounted strangers on horses are conspicuous, and Nightingale has plenty of informers in the town."
"We were thinking about using ourselves as bait."
"No," she interrupted. "That's a rotten plan. The fact that we're together will arouse suspicion. Nightingale's a cunning bastard, and news of my capture has certainly spread, and if anything alarms him, it'll also reach the half-elf."
"So, what do you suggest?"
"We skirt around the town from the east, from the mouth of the Sansreturi Valley. There are ore mines there. I've a mate who works in one of them. We'll visit him. Who knows, with a bit of luck, the visit might prove profitable."
"Could you speak more plainly?"
"I'll tell you tomorrow, in the mine, so as not to jinx it."
Cair threw some birch branches on the fire. It had been raining all day, and no other fuel would have burned. But the birch, though wet, crackled a little and then flared up in a tall blue flame.
"Where are you from, Angoulême?" "From Sintra, Witcher. It's a country by the sea, by the mouth of the Yaruga.
I know where Sintra is."
"So why do you ask, if you know all that? Do I fascinate you so?"
"A little, let's say."
They fell silent. The fire crackled on.
"My mother,"
Angoulême finally said, staring into the flame,
"was a Sintran noblewoman from a high-ranking family, I believe. The family had a sea cat in its coat of arms. I'd show it to you. I used to have a little medallion with that bloody sea cat on it from my mother, but I lost it at dice. That family, though, sod them and their sea cat, disowned me, because my mother was said to have slept with some churl, a stableman, I believe, and so I was a bastard, a disgrace, an ignominious stain on their honour. They gave me away to be raised by distant relatives. Admittedly, they didn't have a cat, dog, or any other fucker on their arms, but they weren't bad to me. They sent me to school and generally didn't beat me, though they reminded me pretty often who I was, a bastard conceived in the straw. My mother visited me maybe 3 or 4 times when I was small. Then she stopped, and to be honest, I didn't give a shit.
How did you fall among criminals?
You sound like an examining magistrate, she snorted, contorting her face grotesquely. Among criminals, for sure. Fallen from virtue.
She grunted, rummaged around in her bosom, and took something out which the Witcher couldn't see clearly.
One-eyed Falco, she said indistinctly, rubbing something vigorously into her gum and inhaling. Isn't a bad old fellow. He took what he took, but he left the powder. Want a pinch, Witcher?
No, I'd rather you didn't take it either.
Why?
I just would. Kaia, I don't use fishtech.
Well, it's clear I've landed up with a couple of goody-goodies.
She shook her head. You'll probably start preaching that I'll go blind, deaf and bald from this stuff, I suppose, and give birth to a crippled child. Leave it, Angoulême, and finish the story.
The young woman sneezed loudly. Very well, as you wish. Where was I? Ah, the war broke out, you know, with Nilfgaard. My relatives lost everything, had to abandon their house. They had three children of their own, and I'd become a burden to them, so they gave me away to an orphanage. It was run by the priests of some temple or other. It was a jolly place, as it happens. A bordello, a whorehouse, simple as that, for people who like their fruit tart and with white pips, get it? Young girls, and young boys too. So, when I joined them, I was too grown up, adult. There were no takers for me.
Quite unexpectedly, she blushed with shame, visible even in the firelight.
Well, almost none, she added through clenched teeth.
How old were you then?
15. I met one girl and 5 boys there, my age and a bit older, and we teamed up in no time. We knew, didn't we, the legends and tales about Mad Dea, about Blackbeard, about the Cassini brothers. We wanted to get out on the road, to taste freedom, to maraud. So what, we told ourselves, if they feed us twice a day? Does that give some lechers the right to screw us?
Language, Angoulême. Keep it in moderation.
The girl hawked noisily and spat into the campfire. Prig. Very well. I'll get to the point, because I don't feel like talking. We found knives in the orphanage kitchen. We just had to wet them well on a stone and strop them on a belt. We made some excellent clubs from the turned legs of an oaken chair. All we needed was horses and coin, so we waited for 2 perverts, regular customers, old buggers of, at least 40. They came, sat down, sipped wine and waited for the priests to tie the chosen kid to a special contraption, as was customary. But they didn't get their oats that day.
Angoulême.
All right, all right. In short, we knifed and clubbed to death those 2 lecherous creeps, 3 priests and a page. The only one not to bolt, he was guarding the horses. We roasted the temple warden's souls until he changed his mind about giving us the key to the coffer. But we spared his life, because he was a nice old gaffer, always kind to us. And we took to the road to plunder. We had our ups and downs, won some, lost some. We gave and took some beatings. Full bellies, empty bellies. We're often empty. I've eaten everything that crawls, anything you can fucking catch, and things that fly. I even ate a child's kite once, because it was made of flour and water paste. She fell silent, then distractedly messed up her flaxen hair. What's past is past. I'll just say this. No one who escaped with me from the orphanage is still alive. The last 2, Owen and Abel, were dispatched a few days ago by Mr. Fulco's pikemen. Abel surrendered like me, but they stuck him anyway, even though he'd thrown down his sword. They spared me. Don't think it was out of the goodness of their hearts. They'd already spread-eagled me on a cloak, but an officer ran up and stopped their sport. And then you saved me from the scaffold.
She was silent for a time.
Witcher?
Yes.
I know how to express gratitude. So if you'd ever like to...
Excuse me?
I'll go and look over the horses,
Kaia said hurriedly, and rose, wrapping himself in his cloak.
I'll take a walk around the place.
The girl sneezed, sniffed and cleared her throat. Not a word, Angoulême, Geralt warned her, genuinely angry,
genuinely confused, genuinely embarrassed.
Not another word.
She gave a slight cough again.
Do you really not want me? Not even a bit?
You've already tasted Milver's strap, little punk. If you're not quiet this instant, you'll get a second helping.
I won't see another thing.
Good girl.
Pits and holes, shored up and lined with planks, connected by footbridges, ladders and scaffolding, gaped in a hillside covered in misshapen and twisted pine trees. Catwalks, supported by criss-crossed posts, protruded from the holes. People were busily pushing carts and wheelbarrows along some of the catwalks. The contents of the carts and wheelbarrows, which at first sight seemed to be dirty, stony soil, were being tipped from the catwalks into a great quadrangular trough, or rather, a complex of increasingly small troughs divided up by shutters. Water, supplied from a forested hillock along gutters supported on low trestles, gushed through them, and yet more channeled it away down towards a cliff. Angoulême dismounted and indicated to Geralt and Kair to do likewise. Leaving their mounts by a fence, they headed towards the buildings, wading through mud beside the leaking gutters and pipes.
"It's an iron ore washing plant,"
Angoulême said, pointing at the equipment. "The ore is carted out of those mine shafts, tipped into the troughs and rinsed with water from the stream. The ore settles on the sifter, and it's taken from there. There are tons of mines and washing plants around Belhaven, and the ore is carted down the valley to Mag Turgor, where there are bloomeries and forges, because there are more forests there, and you need wood for smelting.
Thanks for the lesson."
Geralt cut her off sourly.
"I've seen a few mines in my lifetime. I know what's needed for smelting. Why have we come here?"
"To have a chat with one of my mates, the foreman here. Follow me."
"Ah, I can see him, over there, outside the joiner's shop. Let's go."
"You mean that dwarf?"
"Yeah, he's called Goland Drotstek. As I said, he's..."
"The foreman here, you said. You didn't say, though, what you want to chat with him about."
"Look at your boots."
Geralt and Kair obediently examined their footwear, which was covered in sludge of a strange reddish hue.
"The half-elf we're seeking,"
Angoulême anticipated the question, "had the same crimson mud on his shoes when he was talking to Nightingale. Get it?"
"I do now. And the dwarf?"
"Don't say a word to him. I'll do the talking. He should take you for types that don't talk, just cleave. Look tough."
They didn't have to make a special effort. Some of the miners who were watching quickly looked away, others froze with mouths open. The ones in their way hurriedly stood aside. Geralt guessed why. He and Kair still had visible bruises, cuts and swellings, vivid tokens of their fight and the hiding Milver had given them. They looked like types who took pleasure from punching each other in the face and wouldn't need much persuasion to punch someone else. The dwarf, Angoulême's mate, was standing outside a building bearing the sign Joinery Shop and painting something on a board made of two planed staves. He saw them coming, put down his brush and tin of paint and scowled. Then an expression of utter amazement suddenly appeared behind his paint-spattered beard.
"Angoulême?
What cheer, Drotsdick?
Is it you?"
The dwarf's hairy jaw fell open.
"Is it really you?"
"No, it isn't. It's the freshly resurrected prophet, Lebioder. Ask me another Golan, a more intelligent one, perhaps."
"Don't mock, flaxen hair. I never expected to see you again. Mullica were here 5 days since. He says they nabbed you and stuck you on a stake in Rita Bruna. He vowed it were true."
"Everything has its benefits." The girl shrugged. "Next time Mullica borrows some money and vows he'll pay it back, you'll know what his vow's worth."
"I knew that before,"
the dwarf replied, blinking quickly and twitching his nose like a rabbit.
"I wouldn't lend him a broken farthing, even if he bent down and licked my boots. But you're alive and kicking. I'm glad, I'm glad. Eh? Perhaps you'll pay back your debt too, eh?"
"Perhaps. Who knows?
And who have you got with you, eh, Flaxenair?"
"Sound fellows."
"Righto, mates. And where are the gods leading you?"
"Astray, as usual."
Angoulême, unconcerned by the witcher looking daggers at her, sniffed up a pinch of fishtech, rubbing the rest into her gum.
"Fancy a snort, Golan?"
"I should see."
The dwarf took and inhaled a pinch of the narcotic.
Truth be told, the girl continued, I'm thinking about going to Bellhaven. You don't know if Nightingale and his hands are hanging around somewhere there. Golan Drochdek cocked his head.
You, Flaxenhair, should stay out of Nightingale's way. He's as pissed off with you, they say, as a wolverine roused from his winter sleep.
Blow that. And when the news reached him that I'd been spitted on a palisade by a two-horse team, didn't his heart change? Didn't he regret it? Didn't he shed a tear, foul his beard with snot?
Not at all. I heard, he said, Angoulême's finally got what she had coming to her, a stake up the ass.
Oh, the boor. Vulgar, loutish chump. Prefect Falco would call him the arse end of society. To me, he's what comes out of the arse.
You will be better off, Flaxenhair, saying things like that out of his earshot, and not hanging around Bellhaven. Give it a wide berth. And if you have to enter the town, better go in disguise.
Hey, Golan, don't teach your grandmother to suck eggs.
Wouldn't dream of it.
Then listen, dwarf. Angoulême rested a boot on a step leading to the joinery shop. I'll ask you a question. Don't hurry with the answer. Think it over well.
Ask away.
A half-elf hasn't caught your eye recently, by any chance. A stranger? Not from round here?
Golan Drochdek breathed in, sneezed loudly, and wiped his nose on his wrist.
A half-elf, you say? What half-elf?
Don't play the fool, Drochdek. The one who hired Nightingale for a contract. A contract killing. Of a witcher.
A witcher?
Golan Drochdek laughed, picking his board up from the ground.
Well, I never. Believe it or not, we're looking for a witcher. Look, we're painting signs and putting them all up around here. See? Witcher wanted. Decent pay, board and lodgings included. Particulars at the office of the Petite Babette ore mine. How's it spelled anyway? Particulars or particulars?
Just paint it out and write details. What do you need a witcher at the mine for?
Now she's asking. Monsters, of course.
Like what?
Vespertils and Barbagatsis. They're running rampant in the lower galleries.
Angoulême glanced at Geralt, who nodded to confirm he knew what that was about, and coughed meaningfully to signal that she ought to get back to the subject.
Getting back to the subject, the girl understood at once. What do you know about that half-elf?
I don't know nothing about no half-elf.
I told you to think it over well.
So I did.
Golan Drochdek suddenly assumed a sly expression, and I decided it doesn't pay to know anything about this case.
Meaning?
Meaning it's shaky here. The ground's shaky, and the times are shaky. Gangs, Nilfgaardians, partisans from the Free Slopes, and diverse foreign elements, half-elves, each one raring to commit assault.
Meaning?
Angoulême wrinkled her nose.
Meaning you owe me money, Flaxenhair, and rather than pay it back, you're getting deeper into debt. Serious debt, because you might get a whack on the head for what you're asking, and not with a bare hand, but an axe.
What kind of business is that for me?
Will it pay if I do know something about the half-elf, eh? Will I get anything out of it? But if it's only risk and no profit...
Geralt had had enough. The conversation was boring him, the jargon and the dwarf's mannerisms annoying him. As quick as lightning, he caught the dwarf by the beard, yanked down and pushed him over. Golan Drochdek tripped over the can of paint and fell. The witcher leapt on him, pressed his knee against his chest and flashed a knife in front of his eyes.
You may profit, he growled, by escaping with your life. Talk.
Golan's eyes looked as though they would pop out of their sockets and go for a stroll.
Talk, Geralt repeated. Tell us what you know. Otherwise, when I slash your throat open, you'll drown before you bleed to death. The Rialto, the dwarf stammered. The Rialto bit.
The Rialto mine didn't differ very much from the Petite Babette mine, or from the other mines and quarries that Angoulême, Geralt and Cahir had passed on the way, which were called Autumn Manifest, Old Mine, New Mine, Juliet Mine, Celestine, Common Cause and Lucky Pit. Work was in full swing in all of them, soil and ore being carted out of every shaft and pit to be tipped onto a sluice and washed in the sifters. There was an abundance of the characteristic red mud in all of them. Rialto was a large mine, located near the top of the hill.
The crown had been sliced away and formed a quarry. The actual washing station was located on a terrace carved out of the hillside. Here, at the foot of a vertical wall, in which shafts and drifts gaped, was a sluice, sifters, gutters, and other mining paraphernalia. There was also a veritable village of wooden huts, sheds, shacks, and hovels covered in bark.
"I don't know anyone here," said the girl, tying her reins to the fence. "But let's try and talk to the overseer. Geralt, if you could, maybe don't seize him by the throat immediately, or threaten him with a shiv. First we'll talk..."
"Don't teach your grandmother to suck eggs, Angulem."
They didn't get as far as talking. They didn't even reach the building where they suspected the overseer had his office. They ran straight into five horsemen in the square, where the ore was being loaded onto wagons.
"Oh, shit," said Angulem. "Oh, shit, look what the cat dragged in."
"What's up?"
"They're Nightingale's men, here to extort protection money, and they've recognised me. Damn it, now we're in the shit."
"Can't you lie our way out of it?" Kaya muttered.
"I wouldn't count on it."
"Why?"
"I skinned Nightingale when I escaped from the Hansa. They won't forgive me for that. But I'll try. Be quiet. Keep your eyes open and stay alert. For anything."
The horsemen rode up, with two of them at the head. A fellow with long, grizzly hair wearing a wolfskin, and a young beanpole with a beard, clearly grown to cover acne scars. They feigned indifference, but Geralt noticed veiled flashes of hatred in the glances they were casting at Angulem.
"Flaxen here."
"Novasad, Yerl, greetings. Nice out today. Pity about the rain."
The grizzly-haired man dismounted, or rather leapt down from the saddle, briskly swinging his right leg over his horse's head. The others also dismounted. Grizzled Hare handed his reins to Yerl, the beanpole with a beard, and came closer.
"Well, well," he said. "Our big-mouthed little magpie. Looks like you're alive and well."
"Alive and kicking?"
"You brazen little upstart. There was a rumor you were kicking, but on a stake. Rumor has it one-eyed Falco caught you. Rumor has it you sang like a bird when you were tortured, told them everything they asked."
"Rumor has it,"
Angulen snapped, "that your mother only charged her customers 4 shillings, but no one would give her more than 2. The brigand spat at her feet contemptuously. Angulem hissed again, just like a cat.
"Listen, Novasad," she said insolently, arms akimbo. "I need to talk something over with Nightingale."
"Interesting. Likewise he with you."
"Shut your trap and listen, while I still feel like talking. 2 days ago, a mile outside Reed Bruna, me and these companions of mine slaughtered that witcher the contract out for. Get it?"
Novasad glanced knowingly at his comrades, and then pulled up his sleeves, scrutinising Geralt and Kair.
"Your new companions," he drawled. "Ha! I see from their faces they're no choir boys. They killed the witcher, you say. How? A stab in the back? Or in their dreams?"
"That's a minor particular."
Angulem grimaced like a little monkey.
"The major particular is that the witcher is 6 feet under. Listen, Novasad, I don't want to quarrel with Nightingale or get in his way, but the deal's a deal. The half-elf gave you an advance on the contract, so I shan't demand it. That's your money for costs and for your trouble. But the second installment, which the half-elf promised after the job was done, that's mine by right."
"By right?"
"Yes."
Angulem ignored his sarcastic tone.
"We carried out the contract and killed the witcher, proof of which we can show the half-elf. Then I'll take what's mine and head off into the sunset. I don't mean to compete with Nightingale, because the slopes aren't big enough for the both of us. Tell him that, Novasad."
"Is that all?"
Stinging sarcasm again.
"And a kiss." Angulem snorted. "You can hold your arse out on my behalf, per procura."
"I've a better idea," Novasad declared, glancing at his companions. "I'll drag your arse to him, Angulem. I'll deliver you to him in fetters, and then he'll discuss and straighten everything out with you, and settle up. Everything. The question is, who owns the money from the half-elf Skiru's contract, and your repayment for what you stole, and that the slopes aren't big enough for all of us? Everything will be sorted out the same way, in fine detail."
"There's one snag."
Angulem lowered her hands.
"How do you plan to take me to Nightingale, Novasad?"
"Like this."
The brigand held out a hand.
"By the neck."
Geralt's sile was out in a flash and under Novisad's nose.
I advise against it, he snarled.
Novisad sprang back, drawing his sword. Yiril drew a curved sabre with a hiss from the scabbard on his back. The others followed their example.
I still advise against it, the Witcher said.
Novisad swore. His eyes swept over his comrades. Arithmetic wasn't his strong point, but he calculated that 5 was considerably more than 3.
Get them, he yelled, lunging at Geralt. Kill them!
The Witcher evaded the blow with a half turn and slashed him viciously across the temple. Even before Novosad had fallen, Angoulême ducked forward with a short jab. Her knife whistled in the air, and Yiril reeled away, the bone handle jutting from beneath